Welcome back to another episode of our Clean Sailors podcast. I'm your host, Holly, founder of Clean Sailors. Let's get started. It's an incredibly rare, if not the rarest of opportunities, to speak with a fellow human and sailor who has probably, definitely, the most sea miles of any other, alive or dead. The name Skip Novak will mean a lot to many. For me, he represents incredible adventure sailing, exploration, trusty, solid, intrepid knowledge, the kind of person who has learnt most of the answers, an insight into hidden corners of our wonderful planet, an insight too into our sport and our passion and our pastime of sailing, and given his lifetime of traversing waters all over the globe, and I mean all over the globe, notably the coldest and remotest regions there are, what an opportunity to understand our changing world, our changing seas, our changing climate from someone who really has seen it all. So, Skip, where do we start? So many sea miles under your belt. No one's counting. You're not even counting anymore, correct?
No. I stopped that many, many years ago. Never really did. I just racked them up over the years. And I remember, you know, when I was younger, I think I was in my 30s, I did count up at one stage how many days I'd spent offshore sailing. And it was quite a shock, actually. You know, I was on the ocean more times than I was on land for quite a few years. You know, I loved it.
And we're looking at, I mean, Antarctica, Patagonia, South Georgia, the Northwest Passage, Svalbard, the Falklands, Atlantic, Pacific, South Sandwich Islands, you name it, Skip, you sailed it. But welcome back, as we're talking now, to the UK. Sure. And you're no stranger to these shores.
No, I lived in, I was based in the UK from 76 to about 2000, pretty much, but traveling overseas. And of course, I was down in South America for long periods. Then I spent 20 years in Cape Town, raised a family there, and then only recently came back to the UK with my partner Jennifer from Dorset. So we're based in Dorset now. I still have my little house in the Hamble. Quite a few sailors, you would use that as a refuge. It's very well known. And so I'm back here nowadays, and I still go up and down to Cape Town because we have these two vessels I'm managing come back to Cape Town every year for a refit. So I'm still up and down to South Africa, which I do love. I have to say, I miss South Africa in many respects, climate-wise, geography-wise, etc. Only the social problems became an issue.
Yeah, someone born there myself, as you know, it's a place of many wonders, and I miss it deeply too at times. Skip, you've sailed a lot, and for those who are perhaps less familiar with the significance of your sailing, how would you summarize you?
I would say probably, you know, from when I grew up in Lake Michigan, I'm American. I grew up in Chicago on the lakefront because my family had a string of sailboats. I grew up in a dinghy program there, so I've pretty much not done anything else except going sailing in one form or the other, whether that was, you know, I had about 20 years of ocean racing, or doing around the world races and other ocean races globally. From 77 right through to 2001 was the last circumnavigation I did. I did five circumnavigations on races, Whitbread race and then a millennial race in 2001 on a MaxiCat. So that was one life, and then I sort of overlapped with the expedition sailing, which I started in 86, 87, when we built my first little boat, Pelagic, a 54-foot steel lifting keel sloop, and took it straight down to Antarctica. And that was a culmination of friends from the Drum project in 85, Whitbread race. Three of us decided to put money in and build this boat and go cruising, and we each had a year on the boat, etc. It was a partnership. And then eventually I bought the partners out, recognizing an opportunity to cruise and charter down in the far south, based from Ushuaia and Port Williams in the Beagle Channel, going to places like Antarctica, South Georgia, and sailing up and down the Chilean coast, Falkland Islands, etc. And that's how it all began. That was 88, 89, and I've been down south ever since on a variety of boats that, you know, we built another one, Pelagic Australis, a 74, in Durban, South Africa, and that ran from 2003 to I just sold it in 21 to Greenpeace, and now I'm managing two Pelagic 77 Tony Castro designed with myself as a conceptualist. Very different boats, evolution from one to the other, from Little Pelagic to Pelagic Australis to these two boats, Vincent of Antarctica and a Munson, Pelagic 77s, and we're both now full-blown charter vessels down south based from, again, Port of Williams and the Falklands principally. Yeah. So, yeah, still down there, still doing the same thing, pretty much.
I mean, there's two things in that. The first is, as the conceptualist of these boats, right, because you spent such a significant amount of time, probably the most amount of time of any prominent sailor ever in the Southern Ocean.
I always have to mention one of my mentors down there, Jerome Poncet, on Damien Du and Golden Fleece, and later on his son Dion as well, running Hans Hansen, and the Poncet family is famous. They were down there in the 70s as a family, three children raised on the boats. So I always have to give credit to the Poncets. They were the first one in. They're still down there. And Jerome's actually coming with me to South Georgia in September as a sort of a friend guest, because we're off to do the Shackleton route again. And I'm one of the first, let's say, habitually living down there and sailing and chartering from, late 80s. And there was a few of us, mainly French skippers and myself, started out about a half a dozen.
But over that concerted period of time, and almost as that conceptualist that you've described yourself as, what went into those new boats within your fleet? What is it that you've learned, perhaps most specifically, that you wanted to tailor into your own experience of pulling together a fleet that could sort of withstand these expeditions in these kind of exceptional waters?
Well, there's two things which sort of has gone against the grain of yacht building design and technology going forward over the decades. And one of those is, well, if you wanted to charter habitually down there, you had to have a custom-built boat, really. And I think we're one of the few custom-built boats. Most of the other boats are, renovations and modifications of existing designs. And therefore, you don't have things like a big owner's cabin, which take up a third of the back of the boat or the front of the boat or something like that. Ridiculous sort of concepts. For me, it's a symmetric layout for chartering. And the crew have the same accommodation as the guests. And we're all in one team as soon as the guests come on board, whether those are scientists, filmmakers, just visitors, or adventurists, skiers, climbers, divers, etc. That's the pelagic way. We mold one team out of all of us together, and we eat together, and we help cook and wash dishes and help sail the boat. And that's, I think, been our big strength. And, quite frankly, we have a crew of three on these 77-footers, and we can't really do what we do without help from the guests, whoever they are. And the guests can't get to these places without us. So it's a no-brainer. It's not a classic charter situation of meals appear and the dishes disappear and door closes, sliding door in the galley, and the crew are up forward. That's not how we operate. So that's one fundamental difference, the philosophy of that. The other thing is, if you want to stay in these areas, you have to try to keep the boat as simple as possible. That's what I'm famous for, is not having a lot of gadgets and conveniences and accoutrements that do nothing but complicate your life. I mean, the whole purpose is to get to these places efficiently, no failures on charters due to mechanical failures or electronic failures or whatever, and then come back safely. And to do that, you have to have less is more, is the philosophy of pelagic, and simple systems that crew that we can do running repairs on. We don't need service facilities. People, well, it's impossible flying down from Europe to go to the Falkland Islands easily. It's days to arrive. So we try to fight for simple systems, like we're all manual control systems. There's no electric winches, no electric furlers. And we're pushing the limit on a 77-footer for that. Obviously, if you go to a bigger boat, you do have to go that way. There's no way you can trim sails on a 100-footer manually. So, and you don't want to be any bigger than that. That's the other thing. If you really want to do creative navigation and get in close and give people good experiences and get professional people like scientists and filmmakers close to the wildlife, close to their objectives, you can't have a 120-foot, 130-foot boat. It doesn't work. You have to be too careful. Anchoring way offshore, you can't get in close where we can actually, drive the boat right up in to some very interesting situations. It's still sort of manageable. Following on from that, my little boat, my 54, which I still have, that's the best boat for that, because it's the, smaller the better if you want to do really creative navigations, especially in high latitude environments. That's true for any ocean, tropics, middle latitudes, whatever.
That was going to be my next question, actually, Skip, because I'm interested. 77 is a substantial size let's say, cruising vessel, right, expedition boat, and I can understand being able to navigate into close to the shoreline, obviously in these environments where you have got things like bergs and otherwise, being a little bit flexible to a degree, I can imagine is an advantage. And describing your 54-footer, how small could you go? Because I feel, again, in my naivety and untrained experience, that there's a real balance between being able to withstand those waters quite comfortably at times versus actually having something that can be easily maneuvered.
Yeah, I would say, you know, the little pelagic at 54 feet, you know, we've done some amazing things. It's a lifting keel. You can dry the boat out, run it up on the beach, et cetera, tie it to the trees in Tierra del Fuego, which is great. But it's still safe in the Southern Ocean, I feel. We've done, you know, a lot of time in the Drake Passage and to-ing and fro-ing from South Georgia. And we've been knocked down a few times, but only a few times, and never really had a bad experience. You start to go lower than 50 feet. Into the 40s and 30s, I think you start to become pretty vulnerable for big sea conditions down there. And there are a lot of stories of people on small boats who have been upside down and catastrophic incidents. So, to go any smaller than 50, I think, you know, if you stay down there long enough, something will probably happen. That's sort of my opinion. Yeah. And now, you know, the seas, that's a change. You're probably going to ask me that question later. What changes I see? And one of those is sea conditions and weather have changed a lot over the decades. They're far less stable, far less regular sea conditions, and a lot of warm weather intruding into the circumpolar front, causing sort of mayhem. The seas are now like a wash machine quite often. A lot of different swell patterns that we didn't see before. So, you know, I think we found we've had to be really more careful navigating in these waters than we used to.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen some enormous low pressure systems that have taken up the whole of the South Atlantic. I mean, it's incredible. But for the first time on the 77, we had to wait in South Georgia for a week because we couldn't get back to the Falklands because of an enormous low pressure system with 9 to 10 meters swell predicted. Even the 77, you just don't want to go out there. It's not safe. Never saw that before.
Ah, that feels uncomfortable. I can feel the pit of my stomach when you describe that. But you've obviously, you know, you've sailed, talk about Northern Europe in a second, but you've done a hell of a lot of professional racing also. What is it about the Southern Oceans in particular, about this kind of vast and unforgiving region? And you know, standing on Cape Horn or certainly in the southern tip of South Africa, you have got these three oceans colliding. Even from land, you can feel the sort of magnitude of the energy there. This is somewhere where most only dream to tread. What is it about that for you that just had to be done?
I suppose it's a challenge. Like a lot of things, you know, I do, you know, a bit of mountaineering as well and climbing and things. For me, it's one of these primitive aspects of my life that it's interesting and satisfying to do what are perceived to be dangerous things safely. I mean, that's what I sort of really enjoy, taking on a challenge, planning things out, making sure the boat's good, sound condition, the crews are up to speed, et cetera, and pulling off tricky projects and sort of, you know, getting away with it. And that's sort of what I enjoy. And the Southern Ocean represents all that because it is a tough place to sail. We do sail a lot in very high winds, a lot of big sea conditions, but we know how to do it. And it's very satisfying. And not everybody can do it. And it's also satisfying that as well, knowing that, you know, you've got special skills and you got the right boat and you made the preparation, you know, correctly, and to go back and forth, you know, sort of with impunity. That's not to say that something could happen, as always. It is a high-risk environment. There's no doubt about it. You know, anchoring in places, you know, like South Georgia or the peninsula, you can get yourself in trouble real quick. You always have to have a backup plan, how to get out of there, making sure everything's going to work. And again, that's where simplicity comes in. If you have overly complicated systems, mm-hmm. you press the starter on your electronic engine one day and it doesn't start and you can't figure it out, and all of a sudden you're washing ashore. And these are the type of things we try to avoid by design, by build and fit out, avoid those getting in those pickles.
I hear you. I think there's two things in that. The first is, I am, anyone who knows me, I am very much of the same wavelength in that electronic winches and sort of self-furling, even self-tacking stuff, give me the heebies because you can see so quickly how things could go wrong. And I think particularly in your circumstance where you have got a sizable 77 foot is a big boat, right? And you've got three of you formally as crew who are managing this. Yes, appreciate you've got effectively your guests, right? And the expeditionists with you who can also lend a hand. But again, anyone who has any kind of, who can just step in and support, particularly in an emergency, makes the most sense to me, for sure. I just want to sort of underline how big that is to have sort of three crew on a 77 foot boat in the conditions and the environments that you're in. It's incredibly impressive and sort of, again, iterate your point around, you know, the knowledge that you have earned and the experience that you have earned over your time sailing is not insignificant, Skip.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and also, you know, what I mentioned before about the guests coming on board, all these, you know, various people we've had, you know, we have a lot of non-sailors come on board, a lot of sailors who have some experience and some who have pretty good experience, and everybody can do something. And the only way that works on a sailboat is if you have manual systems. You can't let inexperienced people push buttons on electric winches and furlers. You know, number one, they're going to possibly break something on the boat or wind themselves up in the winches and lose fingers and hands, which has happened on these bigger super yachts and things. So, you know, we can't really operate the way we do with those systems from a safety point of view. You know, anybody, you tell them here, go up to the mid deck and grind the grinder on the reefing line. Everybody can do that safely. It's just a physical thing of winding the winch.
Because you can also see what is working. And I think with obviously a lot of electronic systems, you don't see the effort that goes on behind how things are connected.
Yes.
In a line. Yeah. It's immediately evident, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, we have a lot of rigging because we're a schooner, modern schooner rig, two rigs, the same mast height. You know, we've got a lot of lines and a lot of things to play with, which I enjoy. It's almost like a mini tall ship, this thing. You know, there's a lot of rigging, a lot of ropes. And that's also, you know, an antithesis to modern yacht design. Most boats, they're trying to minimize the rigging on deck. So it all disappears down below deck and pops out in the cockpit. You don't see what's going on. And it's not that evident. Whereas we like to do these things. And also for our visitors, not the professionals, but the visitors, they like to get involved and do this thing and learn these techniques and the physicality of it. It's interesting to wind a winch and get out of breath. Why not?
And also to
sailing? I mean, if you don't actually push yourself a bit. So that formula works. But we're very particular, and I think I get the impression that a lot of designers and boat builders and marine suppliers, you know, when they hear my name, they start to cringe because they know what's coming in a conversation. And I keep saying, well, you know, we really don't need that. We don't need this. And we never had that before. Why should we have it now? And these people are in the business, you know, they're in the business of innovating, of, you know, new ideas and selling equipment. And they don't always, you know, don't always take it well.
But your rules, Skip, though, hey, you know?
That's right, yeah.
You said something really philosophical, and that was the perceived danger, doing sort of perceived danger safely. Is it perceived danger? Because I think it is very philosophical, Skip, because danger is a matter of perception at times, right? But then there are actual dangers. I mean, that there is an element of it being universal, right? That these waters in particular, the high latitudes, but the southern high latitudes, are really gnarly. These are renowned. Why most people don't do that. Describe why you almost said it as perceived danger.
Well, it's because I suppose a lot of people perceive it as danger. I don't necessarily, because I'm used to sailing down there. I know how to do it, and I know how to mitigate getting in situations, probably. And I suppose the other big issue of that is not only the conditions and the high winds, the cold weather, big seas, etc., that are, you know, basically that's endemic down there. It's also the remoteness. You know, if you have a problem in the North Atlantic, you put up an EPIRB, and within hours, you're going to get rescued by somebody. Down south, if you look at marine traffic at any one time, and you look at who's down in the southern regions, it's pretty thin on the ground. I mean, there are cruise ships, you know, on season and going down to the Antarctic Peninsula, so there's a lot of blips on the screen there. But in other parts, like if you go down to South Georgia, it's far less early in the season. There's no cruise ships. South Sandwich, nobody at all down there. So yeah, you are on your own pretty much. And that's part of the attraction, you know, of going to these places and not seeing other ships. That's what I really enjoy, just being out there and not worrying about other ships and traffic, and going to South Georgia early season, where quite often we're the only vessel on the island because the cruise ships haven't arrived. There may be the out fishing boat coming in the port, but yeah, that's what I enjoy. You know, if I want to be in a crowded marina, well, I'll be hanging around Northern Europe and Caribbean and the Med. You know, that's not my cup of tea at all. Never has been.
The element of self-sufficiency that you're getting at also, it's not just being the remoteness of being without people, but you're relying entirely on your own knowledge and your own skills. And I think very viscerally, that's an incredible place for a human to get to, right? Where you can be in those environments and you can sustain not just yourself, but also the others that you're taking with you.
Yeah, it's very satisfying. And you know, the other part of it is the equation of what we do on the boats is, you know, we can't guarantee that we can get anywhere. So that's always very well stated in all our paperwork and on the website. You know, you want to go to South Georgia, you know, here are the possibilities of where we're going to go, but we can't guarantee we're going to get to this one or that one. Take it as it comes, because quite often, yeah, we can do some landings, not all, because of weather or because of ice or whatever. So that's part of the attraction too, is the uncertainty. And that's, like, I suppose the, you know, definition of being on a real expedition, whatever that means, is you're trying something that's not a given. If you want a charter that's a given, charter a boat in the Caribbean or the Med and you get the same itinerary every week on week. You know, pretty guaranteed. Whereas down here, it's not. And that's why a lot of people sign up with us, because they sort of, you know, they like that idea of that challenge and the uncertainty. And that's, yeah, so that's part of what we sell, in fact, is uncertainty.
Yeah, but it's also the antithesis of everything that we as a modern society have created for ourselves, right? We've built our whole economies and lifestyle is built on risk and mitigating against any of those unknowns. So it's somewhat freeing to almost be the proverbial whim of, you know, the system around you, whether it's weather, whether it's sea state, etc. I can see that's a huge draw.
Yeah. Yeah. We went down to South Sandwich, was it last year before last, and we had a 5-week charter, and we spent most of the time dodging a huge low pressure system in the South Atlantic. We wanted the goal was to land on Zawadowski Island. It was the most difficult one to land on. We had been there before. I had camped there before, and this was the second time. And in the end, we only camped for, I think, 7 or 8 days and got the science in we had to do. But that was a 5-week charter, and that's how tough it can be, just to get to a place in the right conditions, get people ashore, established, and then get them off again. But, you know, it was worth it in the end. It's the only way to do those sort of projects, because you know, on a big research vessel like the Sir David Attenborough, this was a British Antarctic Survey charter, by the way, they could never spend the time standing by. The boat cost a fortune per day. There's a lot of other science projects on those ships vying for time on board. And the only way to do these really remote areas is by a dedicated small vessel, you know, dedicated charter for that. And we proved that now, because there was a point in the science projects where everything was done by big ships because they thought this was safer and, you know, there's health and safety issues and this, that, and the other. And, well, talking to a lot of scientists who were on these big ships, they said it was not very satisfying, because we never had enough time to do our project as designed. Because there was always another one waiting in the wings to take the time. So I think there's a good future for us, for, you know, working with people like governments down there, British Antarctic Survey, universities. We've done a lot of work for various universities, and not compromising. This is what we're going to do, and that's it. One thing. Well, yeah.
I think it's also that element of when you're sailing, you're so in the environment. I have some friends who are on a super yacht, motor yacht, don't judge, doing an Atlantic crossing. And I'm like, so cool, you know, that's amazing. How is it? And for them, it's actually really boring, because you're obviously very much insulated in comparison to when you're sailing and you're very much in the environment. So you can imagine also, if people are experiencing these climates and these locations for research or otherwise, being on a sailing vessel is a completely different experience, and in some ways all for the better, I'd imagine. Space restricted, you've not got a lovely laboratory and a kind of, you know, presentation area and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the getting there and getting back and operating while you're in that area. I mean, a sailing vessel, you spend a lot more time outside, you know, by necessity, and it's definitely a better ride. I mean, you know, the motorboats, they can be pretty horrendous, rolling their guts out, and it is monotonous. You're inside the whole time. So if you want to do this type of thing, a sailing vessel, I think, is the way to go. Granted, we do a lot of motoring as well by necessity. You know, when we drop below 6 knots, the engines go on because we got to get there. We're on a job, get from A to B. So we do a lot of motoring as well. You know, motor sailing, assisted motor sailing, and then a lot of pure sailing. So it's a combination of all that stuff. But I think the sailing side wins out in terms of comfort and aesthetically pleasing as well. You know, a lot of the science projects now, they do documentary films tacked on. That be on a sailboat, let's face it, looks better and, you know, environmentally friendly to a certain extent. Yes, we burn fuel, but we burn a lot less fuel than a motorboat does.
You've talked a lot about simplicity, and particularly when it comes to, say, the designs of your boat and keeping things simple and almost taking stuff back to the rudimentary basics of what you actually need. I know you've sort of written, you've seen this film, and Swallowing Seas is perhaps one of my all-time favourite films. And I know that it's quite tragic, and I know that it's incredibly romantic, but it is my kind of go-to film when I need a bit of a pickup. It's also yeah. about Steve, Bob and Nancy. Do you still think that we have this kind of sailing? Because there is an element of me, you know, like we get all the kit and we get all the qualifications and we do all the studies. And there's an element where it becomes, do we over-engineer the experience of what crudely is us being very present on a vessel, again, sustaining ourselves with our own knowledge and experience to a degree in what to me is probably the most romantic thing to do, sailing. Have we lost that? Have we over-planned, over-teched, over-tracked, over-kitted out? How have you seen sailing itself change in that sense?
Yeah, I have to agree with that. Sadly, that's how it's gone. You know, a lot of technologies come into it to enhance, you know, the experience, make it easier, conveniences all over the place. And I suppose the biggest one is communication. You know, when I started out, we had, you know, HF radio that barely worked, you know, in the 70s. And of course, now, yes, we have Starlink, game changer. And, you know, when you have those sort of communication devices, it lends a huge safety plus to all things, for sure. You can run your business, which I do as well. When I'm on board, I run my business. You know, in the old days, before we had Starlink, even with Inmarsat and Iridium, I used to come back after 5 or 6 weeks to weeks of backlog, clawing out and catching up. And now that's disappeared. So there's all those pluses. But, you know, with every technology that comes along, there's always pros and cons. And there's plenty of pros with Starlink, for sure. But then the cons are, yes, it's this loss of disconnect connectivity that we used to have. That was the idea why we went sailing in the first place, to get away from our lives ashore, whatever those stresses and strains or joys would be, to have that break. Now, to have that same type of break is pretty virtually impossible. And the other sort of, I suppose, a negative you could say is that these communication systems lead one to have a false sense of security on the ocean, because there's always that phone call away and a quick rescue and all the rest of it. So that's a game changer as well. So yeah, there's no going back. I mean, you know, I can't advocate, you know, not taking Starlink, because on principle, you know, not, it's like not taking a GPS nowadays. You never do it, because it's there, you use it, it's cheap. Mm-hmm. So that's where we're at. And it'd be ridiculous to forsake all this stuff and go, or, you know, you look at the Golden Globe race as an example. You know, we're trying to go retro back to those same principles. Yes, it's a nice thing to do, but it is sort of a questionable activity. I'm not that much of a Luddite. Yes, so I think the overall experience, yeah, looking at Following Seas, I agree, it's an unbelievable film. I watch it, as you do, every now and again, and show people, and it is incredibly emotionally charged. And you wish you would have had that experience they had, you know, which is impossible to replicate today, sadly. But it is something of, you know, loss of hands-on things they did, and washing up on beaches and salvaging engines and rebuilding the boat in New Zealand. I mean, it is an incredible story. Yeah, very much.
And I think I think that rawness is always the romance, right? And I think in some ways it's subjective, because that was, they were also doing that at a time when this technology didn't exist. So for us today, for many people, yeah, even getting on a sailing boat and getting out there to any degree, even if you've got, you know, the Starlink and you've got the best nav systems and you don't know how to use a paper chart and celestial nav is like way out of your comfort zone, there is an element of just trying and just doing and just extending yourself, yeah, that's unknown, isn't there?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, you sailing is always great, no matter what level you do it. And there's a lot more people doing it now. And that's fantastic. So, you know, you can't gainsay anybody. And this is where we're at today. And, you know, I look back nostalgically at all those type of things like Following Seas film and looking what the Ponces did in 1970s in Antarctica and wish I would have been there then, because by the late 80s, early 90s, it had already changed a bit. And then you look at it today, down in Antarctic Peninsula, for example, when we went down in the late 80s, you know, we were lucky to, there was an odd cruise ship roaming around. You'd be lucky to see one. I think we were, in 88, we were the only one of three yachts on the peninsula that season. And nowadays, it's overblown by ships and yachts going to these high latitude places and everywhere else in the world. So it's, yeah, it's a proliferation and tourism growth. Explosion, which has become an issue for sensitive areas like the Antarctic, no doubt about it. It is sort of in trouble, I would say. It's unsustainable and still growing in terms of numbers.
Let's talk about that. And you alluded to it at the beginning of our conversation, right? Starting from the beginning, high level, what have you seen in your decades of sailing around our world, our planet, change around our climate, wildlife, particularly with your exposure to, say, the polar region? What is happening?
Well, the two big things I would say, well, environmentally speaking, is glacial recession. That's a big one. We've seen enormous changes in that have changed the landscape in places like South Georgia and the Antarctic Peninsula. Weather, as I mentioned before, certainly in the south, more volatile because there's more warm water intrusions breaking through the polar front, making more tricky sailing in the Southern Ocean, I think. I would say from the human side is the just mentioned, the proliferation of ships and yachts. And yachts still account for, if you look at the stats, we get the stats every season after Antarctica by the Antarctic Treaty and the Tour Operators Association, IATO. Yes, there are a lot more yachts down there, but the numbers of footfall and people on board these boats is minuscule compared to the cruise ship traffic, which has become a real issue. And it's the most significant topic in the Antarctic Treaty system, which is one of the most successful multilateral treaties in the world, recognized as such. And the tourism explosion is hot on the agenda of what to do about it, because there's no real way to set a quota because it is international territory to a great extent. But you go down there now and you will never be out of sight of a cruise ship on the peninsula, which is the ice-free area on the West Coast in summer from December to March. The AIS signals on your screen is like a disease. There's just so many because all the zodiacs now have AIS and every ship could have 18 or 20 zodiacs in play. It's very crowded. Very crowded. And the net effect on things like the wildlife, on the landing sites, they study this, you know, all the time about effects of penguin colonies on tour ship visits, etc. That's one thing, and that doesn't seem to really be significant. But then all the other things that are hidden, which are now coming to the fore, things like noise pollution down in the Antarctic Peninsula. You imagine you got so many ships marching up and down, so many zodiacs. A lot of these ships have heli decks, and they have, you know, one or two helicopters up in the air. Many have submersibles. So the amount of noise pollution going through the ocean on the Antarctic Peninsula is pretty dramatic, very difficult to measure. Of course, this is a lot of speculation about how does that noise affect marine mammals, penguins and all the rest that communicate underwater. So that's one thing that's being studied that's obviously quite significant. And then there's things like pollution. There's, you know, the ships, I have to say, are pretty well run in terms of their own, you know, sewage systems and all that, and the scrubbers on the exhaust systems and that type of thing. But what about things like anti-fouling paint? All these ships down there with anti-fouling paint sloughing off, marching up and down continually, how much is that a negative to the environment as well? Yeah, the more concentration of ships you have to, by implication, there's going to be problems for wildlife down south. I mean, that's I think, a given.
It's really, it's such a tense sort of tightrope because it's hard not to be drawn in by the awe of these astounding environments, right? These beautiful, I say somewhat fragile, but they're really actually incredibly hardy by virtue of how long they've been there, how long they've sustained, you know, life. They're a lot hardier than we've given them credit for. Yes, appreciating that they're increasingly fragile now just by virtue of the climatic changes, but they're also diminishing. So at the same time, catch it whilst you can. And there's a natural draw and obviously inspiration and scientific sort of research that comes out of it. But at the same time, again, I've got that really like nasty feeling in the pit of my stomach when you're describing just how many boats there are, plus the helicopters, plus the, I mean, we know that antifoul, we've looked at this previously with Clean Sailors, we know that it's leaving sort of vapor trails in the water akin to planes leaving vapor trails in the sky, you know, of microplastics and heavy stuff. So it is it's definitely a very uncomfortable issue. But how have you seen, talking about some of the treaties, how have you seen also perhaps some of the legislation or regulation change on and around the islands as you've been visiting them over the years? What are the, you know, appreciate that destinations that were probably very, very remote and destitute somewhat in the past are probably now somewhat controlled by permits, or what have you seen implemented there? How does it work?
Oh, yeah. The permit system, you know, in the old days, there were no permit systems. You just went down. Sail down to Antarctica or South Georgia, show up. But nowadays, that's what I spend my time doing in front of a computer is the permitting and the, you know, in the Tour Operators Association, the pre-season checklists and during season monitoring and then post-season reporting, etc. And places like South Georgia, for example, have extremely rigorous protocols for biosecurity, especially trying to keep alien species out by, you know, more tour ships come down, more yachts. They have the, you know, the potential to bring down, you know, things like seeds and things. And all of a sudden you have a proliferation of your alien vegetation. So they're very strict on that. Very good systems in place. And I think that's working really well. And yeah, you have to prove, you know, if you want to sail down to South Georgia or the Antarctic Peninsula, you have to prove viability. It's usually two things. One is safety, your vessel, your safety protocols in place, et cetera, your equipment that all comes into it. And then the second one is the environment, which is really revolving around two things. One is alien species introduction, mitigating that, making sure you're leaving with everything clean. All your equipment that you're going to take ashore has got to be clean, down to picking, you know, picking fluff and seeds out of your Velcro clothing. You know, that we, for all our clients who come on board, we have to inspect all their clothing, all their Velcro closures, their boots, got to be squeaky clean. While we're down there, we have boot washing stations. Every time you go ashore and come back from the land, you have a boot washing station with biocide for your boots and the bottom of your trousers, your ski pole bottoms, tripod. I mean, it's really, and we've got to do all that for sure. So yeah, things have changed a lot in that regard by virtue of the fact of the numbers coming down and the threats to the environment. That's clear. And I think all those systems are working pretty well, I have to say.
Obviously facilitated a lot of scientific research on your boats over the years, from sort of volcanology to ice core sampling. Tell us about some of these. What have been the most perhaps exciting and insightful for you personally?
We did, you know, we've done, I think, three trips with University of Maine climate change team doing ice cores on South Georgia, which was great because it involved, you know, mountaineering skills. So I was leading these teams up the glaciers and camping out and taking ice cores, drilling holes 30 meters down to the bedrock and places, and then rushing the ice cores down to the freezer at King Edward Point and Grytviken to get them, you know, eventually sent to Cambridge and beyond. And so, yeah, I mean, really a lot of great trips like that, fun people. And you know, that's what my big thing is, you know, they come to me and they say, you know, can we do this, look at it and say, yes, this is possible or that's not possible in some cases, and then plan it out with them. And that's what I really enjoy, are these sort of, you know, professional jobs, whether that be science or film. And probably the most exciting science things we've done has been on South Sandwich. We've done three trips there recently with volcanologists landing, taking samples, gas samples and soil samples and rock samples and censusing, you know, like on Zawadowski, there's something like 3 million chinstrap penguins. And we had to, with these guys, they flew drones up and down the coast to try to get images of the whole colony, which is incredible. Mm-hmm. And then using algorithms to count those on a computer to see monitoring the health of the colony. And things like tagging penguins with geolocators. We put geolocators out on penguin around their legs, little button-like devices that sense night and day. And those we have to recoup the following year, try to find the same penguins in the same colony and try to get back these geolocators. And then you get some idea of where these penguins go during winter, because they go offshore after their molt and the chicks are fledged and then disappear. And, you know, this is, where do they go? So, you know, we put off, I think, 45 of these geolocators one year. The next year, we only recovered, I think, four or five, you know, so the hit rate is very small. And there's other GPS tags that you glue on at the back of a penguin with super glue, and off they go. This is now during the season while they're feeding their chicks. And this is to gauge how far they go offshore to feed every day. And then they come back and they're feeding their chicks. And this is really, really good applied science, because it informs governments of the feeding ranges of the penguins. And then the governments can then set no-take zones for the fishing fleet, which they do sell licenses to in their economic zone of South Georgia. So they could say, yeah, you know, no take zones up to 20 miles offshore, because the penguins are going 20 miles offshore for the krill. So this is really useful stuff. It's not esoteric stuff. We've done some very esoteric stuff as well, you know, rock history of the Arctic basin with geologists from Germany, Svalbard, that type of thing, where you sort of ask the question, well, yes, yeah, nice to know, but what's the application? Well, it's not much. Except knowledge, great, okay. It's like outer space, you know. Some and, but other stuff has been really applied, especially the biological science. So yeah, we've done a heck of a lot of that, and we're going to be doing more of that in the future. Because I said before, these little boats, you know, 77 little boat is, you know, is very useful for living space, for space for their cargo and kit, for their equipment. Very efficient for landing, and a very compliant crew, because all the crews we have, you know, our sailors are really interested in this stuff, and that's what they like to do as well. It's not just a job.
I mean, you're right. I can see it's not just a job, it's a lifestyle, but it's almost like, where do you stop? Because this is, I say it's uncharted. For most people, it's pretty uncharted. I appreciate we're getting incredibly familiar with the Antarctic and its movements, but it's still such a formidable environment that there's you could spend lifetimes, I'm sure, picking at various parts of the geography, the pathymetry, the climate, the ice cores, the wildlife, and just, it's almost no end to it. I mean, it's just fascinating.
Yeah. And, as I said, the small boat thing has really been recognized. They were using small boats ages ago. The Ponceys did a lot of the groundbreaking stuff down there on their 56 footer, Damien Deux. And now then the ships took over and small boats weren't in favor. And now I think the people in science are recognizing the small boats are more cost effective, because you can dedicate a project to that and not have a distraction of the big ship having to move off and not being able to do this, not being able to do that. Like, for example, we did a great winery albatross survey last year with Sally Ponce leading that, Jerome's wife. And she's a big expert on great wanderers. We did a once in 10-year census of the great wanderers. And that we did, you know, all the colonies all the way around South Georgia, where there was, you know, five here and 10 there and then 150 there. And the conclusion we came to was that from the last census in 2015, the great wanderers are doing not bad. And because this was always the threat of, you know, albatross decreasing over time due to longline fishing. And longline fishing techniques have now improved to a great extent, you know, sinking the bait and recovering the bait more efficiently so the birds can't get it. So, you know, how do you find this out? You have to go down and count those birds on the ground. You know, that was a great trip. You couldn't do it with a ship. It's like a whole rigmarole to launch a boat, you know, protocols, standard operating procedures, and, you know, hours go by getting ready, you know. Mm-hmm. So we're very fast to react. And hopefully going to do more of that in the future. You know?
If people want to find out about your expedition, Skip, how do they do so? Where should they head?
Oh, well, the website is www.pelagic.co.uk. That's my company who's in charge of all the marketing and facilitating for these two boats, a Munson and Vinson. A good website is vinsonofantarctica.org. Vinson of Antarctica, all one word. And that basically showcases the project, which was conceived by a colleague of mine in Chile, Nicholas Ibanez Scott. And so he and I formed a partnership. He's built the boats, and I run them with a team from Barcelona. That's our headquarters. So it's gotten a lot more complicated, for sure, but a lot more expertise involved. And, you know, if you look at our blogs on the Vinson site, I mean, they're really quite educational and profound. We've got an educational arm as well that's run from Barcelona for schools in Chile and Spain. So it's gotten a lot of a bigger organization, more people involved. We've got 4 sailing crews of 3 now starting in September, shifting between the 2 boats, 4 months on, 4 months off, keep everybody fresh and everybody in the stable.
For anyone who knows me really well, I've got a slight obsession, a massive obsession, actually, with the Antarctic exploration, especially the era of Antarctic exploration back in the day. I was actually fortunate enough to be somewhat coincidentally in Cape Town when Agulhas 2 came back, having found, which was quite something in 2022. Tell us about your Shackleton adventure and the alternative route. What, why, how did that come about? And I appreciate you're about to do something similar-ish again.
Yeah, well, that's one of our, you know, our sort of highlights we do on the adventure side is mountaineering on South Georgia and the Antarctic Peninsula, ski mountaineering mainly, sometimes more ambitious technical climbing and longer traverses. You know, we've done like 16-day ski traverses from the south end of the island to the central section, done that a few times. Shackleton routes, I've done 6 of those, the classic route. And in 2022, we did an alternative route just to do something different, more on the south side of the island, a route that Shackleton could have done and arrived in the same place, crossing more coals, passes, etc. Absolutely fantastic trip. And we usually take about, you know, 4 or 5 days to do the Shackleton route. He did it in 36 hours. Some of the cruise ships offer that as an alternative to do the Shackleton route for their clients. They get maybe 6 or 8 people and 2 guides, and they do it in, you know, 2 days. And so it's too short because the boat has to go around the corner and they have to be there because the rest of the itinerary could be compromised, you know, the other people on board the ship. So again, small boat being totally flexible, dedicated to that project, we can wait for the best weather, take our time, pull sleds, have decent food, enjoy where we are, have time to go off some day skiing trips, go light in the middle of it all, and, you know, come back to the same camp. So it's a great experience. I never get tired of that. And we're doing another one that's starting in the end of August. You know, so we like to do these trips end of winter, early spring. It's the best snow conditions. The glaciers are the safest. All the crevasses are still bridged, and generally better weather. That wasn't the case last September. We had terrible weather down there. We got blown out on a mountaineering trip. But generally, that late winter, early spring is reasonably stable, where you get some multi-day good windows of clear weather and easy conditions. The summer is actually the windiest can be on the mountain.
Yeah. And windy, we're talking wind, right?
Yeah, tent busting winds, katabatic winds. You know, anchorages are pretty tricky at times, and, you know, on the north side, rushing down the mountains. So, over many years of experimentation, trying to climb in summer, which is the obvious time to go mountaineering, you'd think that's not the case. And that holds true for Patagonia as well. It's always the shoulder seasons are the best for a whole bunch of reasons. So, yeah, keep doing that.
And I think if one's going to do it actually by a sailboat, it's just at least a smidgen of a homage closer to those Antarctic great explorers who obviously weren't doing it by ship within 2 days, having to meet the itinerary. Yeah. But the food will never be as good as what you're serving, Skip, I'm sure.
No. I do a pretty good risotto and, you know, that type of thing. We like to enjoy ourselves. We do, you know, that type of thing. We're not trying to, you know, compare ourselves to Shackleton or anything like that. We like to do just see where he's been. It is amazing. The mountains and the landscapes and seascapes are incredible. And just enjoy where we are and have fun. That's what it's all about.
So, so cool. And Skip, if you could leave us, appreciate we've covered a lot of ground and I could sit here for many hours to come, but if you could leave us with one message, either as fellow sailors or as fellow humans, in celebration or warning, what would it be?
Well, I mean, you know, for any sailor, get out there, you know, push yourself a bit, try to do some sailing, you know, alone by yourself, not in a rally. I mean, rallies are very, you know, very famous now because, you know, people have there's sort of a thing about security in numbers and there's a social aspect of getting to the next place. That's all great. You know, you have all these different boat manufacturer rallies going around the world and the Ark. And these are all great events, very well managed. And I see the point. But, you know, for me, it's all about, you know, going off on your own, using your own abilities, getting some solitude, being in the ocean with nobody around, cut yourself off. It's the way to go. You'll come back to land feeling a lot better for yourself.
Yeah. Almost like a better, soulful human being as a result. I'm sure that does stuff to you. Kip, you've been described, I was quite surprised to read this, but you have been described as sort of an Obi-Wan Kenobi Dumbledore character whose, quote, opinions, wisdom, and insight glow like flaming coals in the imagination of any sailor, unquote. And dear listeners, I'm sure you will agree, Skip Novak, it's been an absolute pleasure, somewhat an honor to have this conversation with you on your experience and how our world has been changing. Thank you so much for your time.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Ali. Cheers.
Skip has also written a couple of books, in particular On Sailing, drawing on his long-standing column for Yachting World, where Skip covers traditional skills, innovative technologies, and his own experiences afloat. Well worth a read. For more about Clean Sailors and our projects, just head to cleansailors.com. Thanks for listening, and see you for the next episode.